I could have died. I didn't even know while it was going on. I'm Austin.
And I'm Cloud.
And this is...
In the beginning, before there were universes, there were comic book movies.
There's big trouble in the big city. Crime is out of control. Vice runs wild. Gangsters have joined forces to squeeze the town dry. And only one cop is smart enough, honest enough, or tough enough to stop him. He's so good, Hollywood's decided to make a movie about him. Who is he? Who else? He's Dick Tracy.
Today's movie is Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy is a 1990 action crime comic book movie film directed by Warren Beatty, starring Warren Beatty, Al Pacino, Madonna, Glenn Headley, and Charlie Charisma. How about a plot synopsis?
You literally just heard the plot synopsis. I do not even have to say it.
Okay.
Except there's a kid involved and two women. There you go. I contributed.
The women.
Back when commercials were good.
That's actually not from the commercial. That's from the like half hour TV special making of thing that like aired on TV shortly around the release of the movie, which is mostly fluff and not worth the time. And there's like a couple of facts here and there, but it's really the only thing that there is because there's nothing on the DVD and like literally nothing. Like the only thing that's special about the DVD is that you get a Dolby and a DTS track. Like, that's what you get. There's nothing else. So that's the best place to get any facts at all. But and they are sparse.
Who is this movie made for?
Well, what do you mean?
Is this movie designed? Okay. Let me start from the beginning.
In the beginning.
Okay, so I always like when I think of Dick Tracy, I always think of like not like comic books, but like
it was a strip.
Yeah, and that's what I like. I think of like newspaper. Little comics that you would see in the newspaper. You know, like I don't know what the proper term for them is, and I never would have called them a strip. Like,
I think they are called strips.
And so like because it's just like oh Garfield, like you always know who Garfield is. You didn't have to say anything about that. But it's like it's that kind of thing. Like I always think
does
of it.
Does that mean Garfield is a comic book movie? Does that count?
This is why I drink.
Well, yes, I suppose.
I don't even like Garfield. But that's like I always kind of thought of like Dick Tracy as being that kind of comic. And I was never super interested in him, not just because as a kid, but because there was other ones that were actually funny and maybe the humor that was Dick Tracy went over my head. And like, that's fine. You know, you kind of grow and you adapt and you learn and yeah, that's normal stuff. And then I watched this movie, which I didn't even know existed. And I'm stuck in between wishing I never did. And
is this going to be like back when we did an Elvis movie
or really excited that it exists? Because it's like when I look at this, I'm like, oh, it's kind of designed for children. Like, look how goofy all the villains' faces are. How like it does feel like you're watching a cartoon that's live action. And then there's tits and violence and like good 90s violence.
Yeah.
Before like Michael Bay shows up and makes The Rock.
I mean, it's only rated PG, like, though, so.
Yeah.
Like what's there is like there's a lot of shooting and stuff, but there's not really any blood or anything.
Yeah, there is.
Is there?
Yeah, like in the beginning of it, like whenever they start doing, it's only when they don't kill people outright with gun shooting.
Yeah,
it's like that's when you don't see anything. But it's like, hey, we just shot this place up and there's blood on the walls. You might not have seen someone explode because of that, but it's like gore is over the place. We're just going to pretend, we're just going to move along because it's so fast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, see, the thing is that it's based on comic strips. And what Warren Beatty decided to do was to, like, make it like the comic strips, like, in a way, because this is the year after Batman. So, and they were, like, making it the year that Batman was coming out, and then it comes out the next summer. And so, like, Tim Burton decided with Batman to do it, like, sort of like what the comics at the time were doing. This sort of like Frank Miller kind of period where things were getting sort of dark and serious, and there was a lot less fun in Batman than there had been at other times. But it's still very much and it's very stylized, and there is similarities with the like big matte painting backgrounds and things that you have in this also. Well, but
like the blending in, like actually having an actor or actress in front of something, like, oh, they did such a good job.
Well, yeah, and we'll talk about some of the, because of course we should back up for a second. I'll just put this here. Like, this is a Before the Universe is, as you like heard the thing at the beginning. There's a lot of stuff at the head of this one. There's like 2 minutes of stuff at the beginning of this before we actually say anything. But so we're going to talk about like its place in like comic book movies and like thing more about like how it was made and stuff, such as we know with the limited information that I can find, than we might for other movies. But there's some stuff to say about the effects and the matte paintings and the models and stuff, which is something that some people have criticized Batman 89 for sometimes, where they didn't think that some of the things meshed quite as well. Like, you would sort of pan up to a skyline and you could
easily tell where the
real set ended and where the matte started. But I don't know if maybe some of that isn't stylistic intention, because Tim Burton's a weird guy. And it's only the year before, so it's not like technology and matte paintings and set extensions and stuff are really, really old in film. So it's not like, look at this bad old CG and look at this CG that came out after Jurassic Park. That's worse somehow. And what are you doing over there? But they decided it's going to look like the strips. We're going to use 6 colors. We're going to like the 6 colors the newspapers are printed in, plus black, and like that we're going to make the like crazy bad guys like look like the crazy bad guys in the strips. They're going to have the weird faces and the makeup, and nothing is going to be real.
They do.
It's going to be this whole created world and nothing in this is real. Like, there's never a real building, a real street. Like, the cars are real technically, but they like took all the logos off of them and made them sort of generic because Beatty didn't want it to be like, well, everything else in this world is like fake and created, but there's a Ford over there. So yeah. Like the even the cars are slightly, they had people come in and like sculpt new hood ornaments for them that looked kind of like the ones that should belong on the cars, but weren't quite. So even that wasn't a thing. If you were like some sort of hood ornament expert or something, you couldn't identify them for sure that way. And so everything is fake. And it's all like backlot sets for the streets and actual sets for interiors and models, and nothing in it is real. And even the people don't look real, really, except for Tracy and the kid and his girlfriend and Madonna. And like everybody else, even if they look mostly normal, still has like something weird about them, or they're like. Like the guy whose character name is Itchy, that's the guy that's like always ready to kill everybody, that he's the one that's like uses the wrench to knock the steam valve off when they have him tied up in the basement. And he's always like, he has kind of a squeaky voice and he's making threats all the time. Like he looks basically normal. He doesn't have, you know, like the brow or Lips Manless's lips or anything. He's not that extreme, but there's still something a little like you put, like, you made his face out of modeling clay, kind of. And so, like, you made a face and it's, like, smooth and ordinary, but it's still faked a little bit. And so there's...
Well, I was thinking of, like, Mumbles.
Mumbles, yeah, which is Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Basically unrecognizable. But, yeah, he doesn't really have a lot of, like, alteration either, but he just, like, he still looks mostly like a guy, but...
Well, like, the great thing about him is, like, you can't really tell until, like, his last scene where they, like, play the voice recording and he, like, he's pinching it.
Yeah.
So it slows down. Mm-hmm. And then you can, like, hear his voice and he's just like, aw, shit.
Yeah.
And so he, like, makes, like, a serious face and he speaks, like, proper English.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, wow. Okay. That's not the face he was making a second ago.
No.
What?
There is a, yeah, it's a kind of a neat thing you find out, like, oh, he doesn't just mumble, like, he just talks really fast, yeah. And so, like, you can't hear it normally, but if you slow it down, which, the design of that, like, polar bear water cooler thing is a little uncomfortable, because, like, the valve is in kind of a suggestive area on the polar bear, uh-huh. And so, like, it's not... It's not really that friendly.
I thought it was kind of funny because I expected him to bring a lamp into, like, the apartment where he was at.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you're thirsty? And he has, like, the bear. And I'm, like, expecting, look, because that was what it was earlier. It's just, like, we've, like, been, like, here's a heat lamp and we've, like, just been cooking your face. And so, do you want some water? And then it's like, oh, it's a callback. And it's like, nope, it was a recorder the whole time.
Yeah. Which... While it may be legal for him to take you downtown and sweat it out of you under the lights, is that legal? It seems like a lot of what he does can't possibly be legal. And sometimes he gets leaned on by the chief and the DA played by Dick Van Dyke. But he seems to get away with a lot.
It was comic book legal.
I guess
comic strip legal.
It's comic strip legal. And it's like the 30s or something, even though it's not a real time or place at all. It seems like it's the 30s from the cars and stuff.
Hand me that Tommy gun.
And so, like, there wasn't a lot of, I mean, they do, like, the guys, like, what is it? Is it Flat Top and Itchy, I think, that he brings down to the station, and, like, they want their phone call, and he, like, throws the phone at them after ripping the plug out of it. And he doesn't seem to be, like, they know they have rights, but he's like, yeah, but he, like, he ends up letting him go anyway, and he doesn't get anything out of them. And he's hiding evidence too, because he keeps the earring to himself.
Which
we have this really strange slow motion close up where he picks it up out of the crack and puts it in his pocket and then picks up the thing that he shows everyone else, the walnuts.
Now, see, that was something that kind of bothered me, is, like, I expected more out of the walnuts than what happened, you know? And then, like, I expected more out of the earring, because I know we get, like, a tiny bit of payoff because we're paying attention, but that's only for us.
Yeah, we see him see that she's missing one.
Yeah, and so it's very clear that there. We know he sees it.
She knows something.
But it's not like he's pulling anything else out of it, you know, it's... He didn't bring it up. Nothing else was said. They just kind of gloss over it. And then, like, for the walnuts, I would have liked to have seen Big Boy actually say something about, like, hey, eat some of these walnuts and just, like, whatever, throw them on the ground or something.
A lot of people like walnuts.
Yeah. So that way it'd be like, oh, yeah, like, even though you did pick up the walnuts, you couldn't connect them to me because I didn't touch them. And it would have been very clear that that's what his plan was, because he knew what he's doing.
Well, the thing is that he did touch the walnuts, but he's wearing gloves at that point with his, like, heavy coat and stuff, because it's really unclear, like, what time of year it is or anything, too.
Is it cold? Like, is it hot?
I don't know.
What's happening?
Everybody wears, like, suits and raincoats and stuff. And
now, I'd say the time progression of this movie is a little bit weird, because the last bit of the movie takes place during New Year's.
Yeah.
So we know that it's already wintery, but we don't ever see any snow or anything like that.
No, and we never see, like, we don't go through Christmas or anything.
Yeah, really, and we don't know when the movie starts.
Yeah.
We only know roughly when it kind of ends.
But there's that, like, long montage-y bit in the middle where he's, like, busting up the crime because they have the microphone and the chandelier.
Yeah.
And so that seems like, unless they're, like, doing dirty business, like, a bunch of times a day, like, it seems like there's at least a a number of days that they put the newspaper out a bunch of times at least.
Oh, yeah.
You keep seeing them like Tracy bust this mob under crisis. And
yeah, but that's a minimum.
I mean, they used to print the newspaper like three times a day. So yeah, it's hard
I
to
guess
tell.
You'd say it's like a maximum of 2 weeks based off of the number of papers that we've seen.
Maybe.
Because even if you were to only do one, like one every other day, like there was barely seven or eight of them.
I mean, did the partner guy live in the ceiling for that time? Because he's got like food and coffee and stuff up there, which yeah, spills, are they like doing shifts or
how
something?
How did he get covered in cement?
Oh, it's the bath. Like they pulled him out of, I think they like, they gave him the fake warehouse tip.
No,
and then pulled him out of the ceiling. And then put him in the bath. And then Tracy gets down there.
I'm confused. And like busts him out of it. No, not the friend. I'm not worried about the friend. We watched the friend get covered in the cement.
Yeah.
How did Tracy get covered in the cement whenever Faceless showed up?
Just getting him untied? I don't know. Because it does seem like we don't really see him get covered. And then he is. No Face.
Yeah, No Face.
Is the name. Just like gangster pre-Slender Man, kind of.
She kind of strong for being so small.
Yeah. Well, but it's a comic strip. Because they have like goofy stuff where like he's busting up the crime and like they're having fights and people are like getting punched across the room and stuff. So there's a comic strip physics happening.
You know, whenever they pull the mask off and it's Madonna who's been the Faceless this whole time, it kind of makes sense. I mean, like, because like looking at it through the movie's perspective, every time he shows up, and yes, I'm saying he, it does have that kind of like it fits in. Like, where is she actually at compared to like? So it's like, okay, it matches. Like, they're not in the same place. It's like that's how it goes.
Yeah. Where did Clark Kent go?
Yeah,
he's never here to see when Superman shows up.
And then, like at the same time, like the setup. Like now, some of like what I guess she's trying to accomplish, I'm a little confused by, but at the same time, like it does make sense. So I don't know if she's trying to become like a crime lord or if she's just trying to help Tracy by being like really slick.
I don't know. I mean, because she is kind of getting abused by Caprice. So
yeah,
maybe she just wants to get that taken care of. I mean, she really has it for Tracy though. She keeps showing up and she's like,
we'll see, like it's
we
like,
could just do it right now and we're on this dock and I'll tell you the information, but also mostly I just really want to do it with you.
Yeah, it's like I need some of that Tracy. Yeah. Give me some of that Tracy right now. No, like that's the part of the movie. Like that's like the part of the movie where I'm like they do such a good job trying to show her off where it's like this is what she wants. This is what she's doing. I'm like, you know, maybe it's because it's 1990, but this is like definitely what I would expect, like some adult stuff going on. Cause when you see her the first time, like she's wearing sheer black, you can see her tits literally.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we are absolutely showing her off. And I'm like, OK, yeah, all right. I'm OK with this. And then like later on, they're like, hey, we are going to have her as almost revealing as socially acceptable in a movie in the 90s since the 90s just started. So I guess like whatever the 80s, you know, with the 80s, whatever. I don't care.
Yeah. The black dress close to the end.
Yeah. And then it's just like, oh, OK, well, yeah, it's a kid's movie.
Well, it's not really, though, is the thing. Like,
everybody is super cartoony.
It's bright colors and stuff. It's cartoony, but...
And the kid, yeah.
Yeah, the kid. But that doesn't mean that it's, like, made for kids or anything.
Who'll probably, like, turn 14 and be like, you're not my real dad. I don't want to be Dick Tracy Jr. anymore.
I mean, the strip... Well, actually, wait. It seems in the 30s that the... there were some really serious, like... Not custody exactly, I guess, but like really serious, like you can have a kid or not laws happening. Cause it's like we see the woman like shows up to like take him to the orphanage, and it's been like weeks, and she's been like trying to, like, they're chasing down this kid, like, you know, like he's wanted for crime or something, yeah, but he's just wanted for being an orphan.
How's and the food?
Like, it's good. Like Tracy says, when he's telling him about the law, he says, like, unless you got a home with a mom and a dad. So, like, can you not have like one or the other? Or, and they still take your kids? Like, how much family do you have to have to, Jesus, be allowed to have a kid?
I mean, I'm just thinking about like 30s, World War One. How many people were left? Like, I'm a single parent now.
I know. Well, and the, like, the orphan, like, why do you want to put kids in the orphanage? Like, isn't the orphanage always like under, like, over budget and too full? And like, they, it seems like if someone is like, yeah, I'll take care of this kid,
you'd be like, and, thank, and it's God, not like, get him out of our hair.
It's not like guy in the shack saying, I'm going to take care of this kid. It's like, this guy's like, he's got a job. He works for the city. Like, seems like an upright kind of guy. So we can probably trust him to take care of a kid, even if it's not actually his. There does seem to be some pressure, I guess, that like we need to get the, like, if they get together, then, yeah, that makes a home for the kid to be.
And then, and, like, they do kind of ham fist it a little bit, especially towards the end, whenever it's like, oh, we've never seen him this way. Where's Tess? All this kind of stuff. Yeah. I guess I won't have a mom and dad now. Well, the orphanage, and it's the law, and it's like Tess has been kidnapped, and, oh, I'm here to take this child who is just going to jump out the window.
Yeah, and it's the only time that someone shows up saying they want something and it's actually them.
Yeah.
Usually it's the gangsters pretending to be somebody else.
Ring, ring, I have pie.
Yeah, and so, like, it really is the woman from the orphanage. And she just takes him. They don't wear suits, though, in the orphanage.
No, but they all wear the same thing.
They do. They wear some, like, denim.
Which is weird, because you'd think if you already have some clothes, you wouldn't have to, like, waste clothes on them.
I guess, but they've got to be like washed and stuff. I don't know. It's like basically like prison. Like the orphanage is like prison. It's like kid prison. Like the food sucks.
Unless our listener lived in an orphanage and wants to tell us otherwise. I don't
think anybody lived in like a 1930s orphanage. So
yeah, okay, that's true. That's
like
true.
We don't. I think it was a different time, you know, or.
If you lived in a 1930s orphanage, let us know so we can be amazed at the fact that you lived in the 1930s in general.
Yeah. And not like I was in an orphanage that was like that existed in the 30s.
But like,
you were in an orphanage in the 30s.
Don't come at me with that weak shit.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it was a really old orphanage, but it's still operating. Like
I was an orphan in the 30s. I served in World War II. Because, like, that's kind of the stuff that happened.
I guess so. There was,
I salute you.
You know, now we mostly just have, you know, like foster homes and things. There's not like the, you know, the orphanage from Annie doesn't really seem to exist anymore.
Yeah, you're not going to get adopted by a senator.
Like have just like hundreds of kids in like a brownstone or something. And
hundreds.
Maybe it's not hundreds. There's a lot of people in the orphanage in Annie.
They just like pour out the windows.
They do pour out the windows.
That's why they always leave them closed. You know, they're all hot and sweaty and they stink. And that's why no one likes the kids and no one gets them. And because they're hot and sweaty, they bundle up and they're still hot and sweaty and no AC because no one can afford it. That electric bill's too high. Uh-huh. But if you open up the windows, the kids are just going to pour right out.
It barely exists in the 30s air conditioning. So,
like, we had an ice block and some guy with a fan, and you gave him a nickel and he'd wave the fan a little bit harder.
A nickel. Now there is a recurring thing here that's one of the things that recurs on the show commonly. There are a lot of split diopter shots, like a lot of them.
Yeah.
Which, if you don't remember what that is, it's where you have a half a lens that's a different focal length, and the other half is empty, so that then you can have it's blur in the center, but you can have something close in focus and something far away in focus at the same time, and do it in the same shot rather than like compositing it or faking it somehow. And they do it so much. And like, I think it is maybe trying to be a like panels of the comic strip thing, And I like this approach to it so much better than the like partitioning things off with actual lines.
Yeah,
they do
it's like because they do in the Hulk clean. Movie. And
yeah, well, it's clean. It gives you a feeling of what they're trying to do, but it's still, I mean, in a movie that is so like faked and like comic booky in other ways, it's like a film way to give you the feeling of a comic book idea rather than just because they, I guess, as pushed as everything else is, they might as well have just drawn lines on the screen too. Yeah. But they were making a film still. So, and it would have been a lot harder to do something like that than it was by the time you get to the,
yeah, just
to the Hulk movie.
Just throw a lens on it.
Everything's floating around here and there. Oh, actually, I guess it's called the blank, not no face, even though I don't think anybody ever says that in the movie. I think somebody says no face.
I'm just more interested in everyone else's face. We just go with that.
I mean, well, the no face's face isn't even a face. It's just it's the only mask. Like, everybody in the movie is wearing a mask, kind of, or wearing makeup. But it's supposed to be their actual face.
Literal.
No
mask.
Face is like, oh, it's actually a mask, and there's a real face under there. So you've never seen this before, you said, right?
I have not.
Okay. I kind of thought that we had watched it in the apartment, maybe, but I guess
nope.
Maybe that was with Kenny. I'm not sure. But the you did figure out that it was. That it was Madonna.
Well, like whenever they pulled the mask off, like I wasn't surprised.
Oh, but you didn't.
Finished the thought. This thing was like whenever he didn't shoot him, I was like confused, and it was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like it was like this thing where it's like I was trying to figure out who it was this whole time because I was thinking like, oh, it's actually like a third bad guy that's in. It's just like, oh. I thought you were going to shoot him. You could have totally shot. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. It's just Madonna. Whatever.
And we didn't even mention specifically, but we should, I guess, that like the everything being primary colors thing is like the costumes, too. So you get a lot of like wildly colored suits, like beyond just Tracy's sort of iconography of the white coat or the yellow coat and hat.
Literal colored suits. Like the kid wears red constantly.
The kid wears red.
I don't want to have to wear a suit. Like if you don't want that suit, you can wear a different suit. Jesus.
Yeah. Pick the suit you like, he says.
Really?
But suits are for school when that means the orphanage. But then they don't wear suits at the orphanage, so. He had some bad information, I guess. There's not really anything weird about Al Pacino's face. Like, he has, like, really slicked down hair. But, like, he has, like, there's something weird with his shoulders, and he kind of, like, hunches over.
I would say his face kind of reminds me of, like, a chemical burn. Or like liver spots where it's like it doesn't look fake as much as it just looks like what I'd expect to happen to someone's skin as you got older.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, he's sick. Got like a big chin, too. Yeah. That I guess they've added. But yeah, he does have a something happening with his face. But he's much less extreme. And I don't know if maybe that's because you don't want to like bury Al Pacino under makeup, but. They bury everybody else to greater or lesser extents. But it's like, you know, Paul Sorvino is here, whose lips, which is like basically the character that he plays in a lot of things. It's just this time he has like exaggerated gangster lips, but like he's still the like guy with the nightclub. Like he plays basically the same character in The Rocketeer and like. Even like the character that he plays in the Law and Order episode that he's in is basically that. Like, he's like a gangstery kind of guy. He plays a lot of gangsters, but he's really sucking down those oysters. So other like production-y things. That train is a model. like the train that the kid like runs in front of. Yeah, it's a model.
He's also dead.
It's not a real train. It's a big model. It still is like a 1,000-pound model, but it's a model. You know, it's only probably like, I don't know, 2 feet high or something, which is one of the things you there. They do have a moment of like seeing it with like a guy like leaning down next to it on the model set in that the weak TV thing, which is it's even weaker because of the name, because it's called Dick Tracy Behind the Badge Line Behind the Scenes. And so it's like, it's not behind the badge. It's not real police, even though they do seem to have that weird hedging thing at the beginning where it's like, he's a detective so good they decided to make a movie about him. And it's like, well, except he's not a detective. He's a fake detective. So like,
so did they make a fake movie about him?
I don't know. I mean, they made a real movie, which we should also say there was a series of 4 Republic movies in the, I think in the 50s maybe is when they were made. And so it's, this is not the first time that it's been on a movie. Those were all only about an hour long though. And they were, you know, made by Republic Pictures. So they're what you get with, you know, it's like all of these are basically made by Republic Pictures, the Batman ones and the Superman. Like there's all these properties that were made into like vague serial type things or movies or something in the 40s and 50s. This one, the writers of this, Jim Cash and Jack Epps Jr., are the guys that wrote Top Gun. So
I'm not surprised, but also that's also what this surprised? Movie does a lot of shit. It's
you're
like
surprised, I'm not surprised and not surprised. Surprised
all at the same time. Like, why does this movie do this to me?
I don't know. It's things that you haven't seen before that are unusual. Like, hey, we made a thing that people don't make. I guess maybe do that. And also in relation to Batman.
Batman kick his ass.
Well, the music is by Danny Elfman, which if you listen to that part, that's in the part that I played at the beginning, that part of the main theme. Like, were you surprised at all when music by Danny Elfman came up like 30 seconds later in the opening titles? It's like, it's so close. Not that Danny Elfman can't write a wide variety of things, and the rest of the music isn't.
Maybe he just like, chooses not to.
Dead on Batman. But like, that one thing is so Batman. Like, yeah. It's so Batman. It's crazy.
Yeah. Whenever like the intro. Okay. So like, I'd say the first maybe 4 or 5 minutes of this movie, I thought it was going to be like super dark and dreary. And then it was just like, haha, look at these cartoon characters.
Yeah, at the poker game.
And then it was just like.
Well, even before that, like the first, like the opening, like shots are really, like I really enjoy where it's like the hat and the telephone and the red with the desk, and that it's just these like process things, and you get to see the bright colors right away, and you see that like there's a person here that's important, but they don't let us see his face until later. Actually, I guess you don't really see his face until they come out of the theater, right?
Or something like that.
Because he goes to the, like, he leans over and says, like, I have to go check out this crime scene. I'll be back. I want to see how it turns out. And then he goes and checks out the crime scene, solves the crime, and then like, comes back.
Yeah.
Like, sits back down. Which it seems like they're seeing an opera, like,
that's what it looks like.
Like a matinee opera. Because it seems like it's in the afternoon. Which then it gets dark really fast, but it
must be a long matinee.
Well, it's an opera, so
I didn't say opera. I said a long matinee.
Operas, they're kind of long. But like, let's.
I would be terrible at an opera because at some point when they got like,
like let's just listen. It's not that. It's like it is that part, but then like when the brass comes in like after this. Even that kind of.
I kind of expect like the camera to be panning up on a building and you see Batman standing on the corner.
I know. And I guess it's just like, I like this brass sound and I'm Danny Elfman. Like, right there. It's almost the Batman theme. Like, it's the same brass and everything. Like, it's crazy.
See, I don't... I don't want to be mean about it in that kind of context, but, like, it's kind of like Christopher Nolan. Like, if I hear it, I always think, oh, that's Christopher Nolan, and I always think of, like, Inception meets The Dark Knight. You know, it's just like these little things where it's like someone has made something that is so good and so iconic that anything else they do, people can always kind of like piece it together where it's just like, hey, isn't this made by insert composer? I remember it from this movie, insert movie, and this character, insert character, reminds me of it. So you just kind of picture that.
Well, so you actually mean Hans Zimmer, right?
Yeah, what did I say?
You said Christopher Nolan.
Oh yeah, Hans Zimmer. Yeah,
they work together commonly
a lot. Yes,
and both the Dark Knight movies and Inception are both by both of them. But
yeah, Christopher Nolan doesn't write music. He did the Superman music.
Yeah, he did that too.
Yeah,
which is also like sort of a Nolan like thing. Like he produced it and made it dark and stuff.
Yeah,
which is why we don't know who to blame for the current DC movies. If we should blame Snyder or blame Nolan, probably both. There's another, like, it's really early, but there's a moment that I really like with the like using the matte paintings and stuff where the, like, we're in an area and then they pull way up and we see the city and then they push way across what is just like not there. It's just a matte painting. Like it's an insert of the actual shot in this like big matte painting on glass, like the way that they used to do it, where you would insert like the city, the Rome Square in Spartacus is done this way, where it's a big piece of glass with a cutout where the thing that's going to be the actual real thing is. And so because of the way you can light glass compared to a surface, then it makes it where it seems like it's all one piece more than if you do it some other way.
Yeah.
And they do it that way and they pull way out and then we go across and then we go into what's supposed to be another part of town. And they do it in this, what seems like one shot. And it really sells the matte painting thing for the rest of the movie.
Yes.
Cause we do it in this one thing, this one time. And it's really good. Like, I really, really appreciate it. So we've talked about generic square jaws before.
Yep.
Which Dick Tracy, the strip character, is like the square jaw. Like he has like corners on his jaw the way that he's drawn. So like he is the square jaw. Warren Beatty doesn't have that much of a square jaw. Like he isn't that good at being a generic square jaw. So
yeah, but he has a clean, like slick kind of face.
He does, yeah.
So it's not like, okay, because like I would say, like, whenever you have somebody who is square jawed compared to like somebody who's like thick faced or kind of weaselly, if you will, like they have like a really scrawny face, and he doesn't have that. Like he has enough leanness to his face that it can look kind of square based off of what you're wanting to do with it. And since it doesn't fit like the thick or the weaselly, he can still pull off that type of look without having to have that square. And then having the same color coat helps.
Yeah, well, it really is the coat and the hat. So you can just see him from a distance and you see the yellow because there's not much other yellow.
And you don't think of, you know, Go-Go Gadget.
No. Well, that's brown anyway, but I mean, it's always bothered me, the like unimaginativeness of a lot of people where like they've somehow for themselves picked one fictional character that wears a fedora. And like that's what they always reference whenever they see one on somebody else, even if it's not the same color or the same style or even the same like time period.
M'lady.
And so like, yeah, well... Like the there is a fairly sizable difference between the Inspector Gadget hat and actually there's a big difference between the Inspector Gadget hat and the Indiana Jones hat, because the Inspector Gadget hat is a trilby, not a fedora. Anyway, the crease goes all the way from one end to the other. It doesn't have a pinch in the front. So it's not even the same kind of hat. It's just a similar hat. And like it has a brim and it's from basically the same era. And so I guess if you don't have like hat facts right at hand, then you don't know that. Maybe,
get educated. Yeah.
Now they screw it up, I guess, with the Matthew Broderick movie, because that is much more of a fedora than a Trilby. It does have a pinch and it's not really the same as the cartoon is. But then, you know,
a Fallout character wears a Trilby.
Oh. But then especially here, it's yellow.
Yeah.
Nobody else wears a yellow. Like if you watch the Siskel and Ebert episode where they talk about this movie, Gene Siskel is like, I didn't think much of Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy, except for the period clothes. And then Ebert says like, well, I don't think that yellow hats and coats were ever like period clothes. They're like just from this like imagined comic strip world. And so he's like really kind of snide about it. And like that's kind of true. Like there was some bright color-y kind of stuff in the sort of zoot suit kind of period. Largely though, it was like big pinstripes and patterns and things more than it was like weird primary colors. It
looked like you took like a piece of furniture and you stripped the cloth off of it and made a suit yeah. out of it.
Well, even like if you look at the suit from The Mask, like that's a yellow suit. And a hat. That's not a fedora or a trill. I'm not really sure what it is. Like, I can tell you what it is. Suit hat.
I can tell you what it is. You want to know?
Huh?
It's smoking.
It is. That's true.
I earned a point. I should get a point for that point. One.
We don't have like a lot of podcasts of like bells where like they give people points. We've never subscribed to the bell thing.
We need to like draw. I don't know. Like I see this light bulb on the table and I'm just kind of like we need to like just throw a light bulb and hear it crash on the ground. Replace that.
So I've always felt bad about the end of this because they shoot up all those cars. And like, I know they're like movie cars and like that. Wait, it's OK.
Do you feel bad for the cars?
I feel bad for the cars. I feel bad for wasting a lot of old cars.
Oh, OK.
That there aren't that many of. And like, you don't know, because like we have probably 20% in existence of all of the 69 Dodge Chargers that were actually produced, because most of them were destroyed over the course of the production of the Dukes of Hazzard series. So like that's why they're so expensive now, because there aren't very many, and also because people want them to turn them into General Lees, but they're still extra expensive because there are so few, because they tore up so many of them making the show, because real cars can't jump bridges and survive. And like they rebuilt them over and over as many times as they could, but there's only so many times you can do it. And so you end up going through a lot of them over like 11 seasons of a TV show. So there are many fewer. And so like sometimes they do destroy actual things in order to make a TV show or a movie. And so I don't actually have real information whether or not they like shot up or squibbed or whatever actual like working 30s cars or not, because there's so little about the production of this. And so I still don't know whether maybe I should feel bad that they shot up a bunch of, because like, do you remember in Home Improvement, the episode where Tim like accidentally drops an I-beam on Jill's old Chevy, and like it's been like such an important car for a big part of the series, and it's a Nomad, right? I think, I don't know why I couldn't pull it. It's really important. But Tim Allen being like a car guy in real life also made a big point about how he made sure when they were going to do that like they found one. Like, because they had like the hero one, that's the one you saw for the rest of the show that they actually drove around and stuff. And the one that's in the earlier shot that they drive into that position. But then they switched it out with one that was like unrecoverable. Like they put paint on the outside of it, but it was like you couldn't restore it. It was totally wrecked. And like you could only show it from that one side. And he made a big point of making it really public that they didn't actually destroy one of those, because they're really rare, and it would be wrong to destroy one of the few remaining ones just for this funny moment on this TV show. And so, but there's nothing like that for this. Warren Beatty supposedly is a car guy, but I haven't found anything of him coming out to say like, no, we didn't actually destroy all these 30s cars, because they blow up one of the police cars, too.
Yeah.
Which no,
they blow up like what, two cars?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
They blow up the one for the gangster and then they blow up one of the police cars.
But the police car that explodes while he's like shooting this Tommy gun the other way.
Yeah. And then like some of the cars catch on fire.
They do catch on fire. But like, that was like a really scary moment for everyone except him, because they didn't really mean for it to explode right then.
Ah.
And so like he has earplugs in so that he doesn't hurt his ears with the Tommy gun, and he didn't hear it blow up. And so he doesn't react. He just keeps spraying his Tommy gun around, and they finish the shot. And then after the shot, people were like, how did you like hold it together and not like flinch when the car exploded behind you?
What?
And he was like, I didn't hear it. I didn't know. And then he watched the shot afterwards and was like, oh, I could have died. I didn't even know while it was going on. And so
somebody hand him some scotch.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, in the way that the Superman movie was, a movie that was almost getting made for a really long time. Like the starting in like the mid 70s somewhere, there was an attempt to make it. But there were rights issues, and the guy that wrote the strip was trying to exert creative control. And so it kind of kept getting pushed around. And, you know, various people, including Martin Scorsese, were considered to direct it at various times. And actually, now we have it written by the guys that wrote Top Gun. But one of the earlier versions was actually being written by the guy that wrote the first two Superman movies. So we could have had the same guy again, like creating these early days comic book movies. But that ended up not happening because the creator didn't like what they came up with. And so it took until when it did to come out, to even get made. And then it ended up being Beatty that was doing it. And it was expensive.
I mean, it looked like it was expensive.
It cost $46 million at the time in 1990, which is a lot at the time. So it only made 162, which is part of the reason why we don't have like a real good special edition of this, and not really the reason that we don't have a sequel, because there has sort of been attempts here and there, but it's all tied up in rights issues again. And so there's not much anyone can do. But it didn't lose money, but it didn't make as much money as Disney would have liked to have. So how do we feel about stars?
I don't know. Like, I have like mixed opinions.
As you have had about it the entire time.
Okay, so here's the weird thing. There's nothing about this movie I dislike. Like, nothing. I can't think of a single bad thing to say that I would actually, you know, have a complaint over. But I'm not going to say, hey, this was a great movie and I had so much fun watching it. It's just like, it's meh, but it's better than just meh, but it's not like meh. I guess that makes it a 4, probably a weak 4. Cause like 3 would be like this in like center ground.
Yeah.
But I know it's better than that. Cause like I said, like I don't have any complaints over it. But I wouldn't give it a 5, like, because if I never watched this movie, I wouldn't have missed anything. But I've watched it and I'm like, hey, that's not complete garbage. Like, that's pretty good.
I think you might have missed something in that it's like the most like we're going to commit to making things look like a comic book on film that exists. So,
yeah, I mean, like
that. But if there's nothing else.
I'd say a 4 would be a fair and as accurate statement I can make for a rating on this, just on like a personal experience.
I think that is probably fair to. I've seen it several more times than you. And like, I do like it. And I think that there is like a special particularness to it, which doesn't necessarily make it good. But there is, I don't know, there's something. It may be that it's like a really good version of what the Dick Tracy stories are, which are like kind of like basic detective-y things with like some humor and like a bunch of weird looking characters. And so maybe like, since that's what's here, maybe it is like a perfect adaptation, but there's something about it that's just not as like, I want to say dynamic as it could be, or as like driving as it could be.
I don't know. See, that's
which is
that's,
mostly this. Like, I think it's mostly just like there's a, something about the story that's like the story could be like a little something else, and then it could be a, like the whole thing would be a boom cannon, but it's not quite there. So
yeah, well, it's like okay,
I think it
like,
is a four. Probably.
I think the acting is great.
So the acting is great.
The kid did not annoy me.
No,
I didn't.
Which is unusual for kid actors.
Yeah, I don't have any like. These problems wouldn't have happened if you would have just listened. They established the cartooniness. So like anything that I would have complained about being stupid.
Yeah,
I don't have anymore because it plays into the fact it's so cartoony. The story, while not being the best story ever, I think it's pretty basic. But for telling a basic story, it does a good job.
Yeah.
The montage is appropriate for this type of movie. Like both of them, the one where it's
they do it both ways. They do the we're catching the bad guys and the bad guys are making money.
Yeah. And so it's just like I don't know of anything in this movie that they did wrong. I just don't know how to make it better. Because I can't look at something and go, I would have done this instead. Like maybe if they would have tried this. No, I don't like the dialogue out of this character. It feels a little weak. Like I cannot think of anything.
No, I can't place it.
Yeah.
But there's just something. There's a somethingness about it. But it's still,
I like it more than Inspector Gadget.
Yeah. I think that's probably the most disappointed that I ever was going to see a movie in the theater as a kid. I guess you like you came in being like, what was this I just saw?
And well, like, so, yeah, like that's the thing is it's like it mixes me up so much because in every aspect, I'm like, this is good. But in the same very much aspects, I'm just like, I don't care about this. So it has conflicted me so much.
Maybe it's like a something you have to think about for a while to like figure out what you mean.
Because like when I was watching it, because I watched it the other night and then I watched some of it before I came over here because I wanted to like re-go over certain points.
Huh.
And because like that was one of the things that I didn't pay too much attention to was the girlfriend or whatever. Jesus Christ.
Tess.
How did I mess that up?
I don't know.
How? I should. I need some dinner. I'll probably get some later. Tess talking to her mom.
Hmm.
I would say on the original first sit down watch kind of thing, maybe the only scene that I didn't care for. But I understood why it had to be there.
Hmm.
And it wasn't bad. I just didn't care for it. And then Exactly. I need that on a shirt. You don't like on the front, like we don't hate you, we just don't care about you. I bet I could sell that. But I watched that part again. And one of the things that they do kind of put a little hat on is when her mom's telling her like it takes like a special kind of understanding to love a man like that.
Mm.
And then she just has like this epiphany.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if we're supposed to think like her husband was a cop or something, too. So she understands, or if she's just like a mom who understands things or what. But
well, like, you see that then that's the thing that kind of kills me. It's because like the statement that the mom made beforehand is going to be something where it's just like, I think that was the more important statement, where it's like, he can only love someone else, or he can only treat you as good as he can treat himself.
Yeah.
And he does seem to do a pretty good job of treating himself well. Like, he's very, I guess you'd say, vigilant and pours a lot of himself into his work. But, you know, the only time we ever see him in any form of negative light is whenever she leaves and yeah. he's like having to struggle because now he's conflicted and he's like being like everything's falling apart and he doesn't realize it, but it's affecting him.
He does seem to eat only chili, though.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's a character kind of, it's like Sonic eating hot dog or chili dogs.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to complain. Plus, they always have it as like, oh, it tastes better. Did you wash the bowl?
Well, he does. He does it in the diner, but he also has like cans that he's like just dipping a spoon in and out of. Like, he's doing it when they bring the guys in for questioning. And then he's doing it a couple of times during like the depression montage. So it's like, if he can't make it to the
depression chili,
if he can't make it to the diner, he's got cans of it around.
Yeah. And
I'm not going to say anything in detail because I want you to experience it, but you have not seen depression chili if you have not watched The Good Place. So like, go and find out.
Yeah. But I would say my feelings are essentially what that scene was. She sits down, talks to her mom. Her mom says all kinds of stuff that is kind of important while she's not paying any attention. She hears something and then it creates an epiphany. And then what created the epiphany was stupid and shouldn't have actually created an epiphany, but the other stuff should have.
So, like, there's a falseness about things, or I'm not sure.
I don't know. That's what kills me.
Well, I have to come back to your thoughts about this after some time has passed, I think.
It's been 5 years, and we finally sat down and watched this movie again.
Uh-huh. Well, no, I mean, not that, I mean, but just like, even without watching it, just like, maybe you can like, maybe you'll have an epiphany. You'd be like, that's what it is.
Because like, that's one of the reasons why, like, I was like, hey, I'm going to be a little bit late. I need to rewatch some of this stuff. It's like, maybe 7. The Madonna thing at the end didn't surprise me. It's just that mom thing just kind of, I don't understand what the writer was trying to get at. Like, it didn't, maybe that's what it is.
You don't know what they're going at?
Maybe that one scene was so bad that my brain won't process it as being bad.
Hmm.
And that is what's bringing it down, and I don't understand it. And so I'm having to fill in the blanks.
Okay, so we should say about the story. So there was the story, and then there was the guy, as there often is, writing the novelization. And his novelization was varying a bit from the movie itself, which also often happens. And Disney was like, hey, you got to make it like the movie. And he was like, but I'm making it good. And there's like some like real plot holes over here in the movie version of the story. And they were like, what, you got to make it like the movie. And so then Beatty was like, OK, let me look at this and I'll take a few of these pieces from the book and fix some of the plot holes. And then like both can just stay the same. And so like there's some things apparently that were worse, like that were like what made there were a bunch of the mom scenes, I guess. And the guy writing the book fixed them, and then they moved it into the movie and fixed them there too. So maybe that's just one that got missed,
maybe,
or something.
Maybe so. that's what we're gonna have to go with. That's all we got.
Huh. This is a weird thing. I don't remember. It's a weird thing for you, particularly. I think it's not a common thing that you're not sure what you think about something.
Yeah. So. I am very like on point.
Yeah,
but like, god damn.
This part does not sound like Batman.
Nope.
That part, but...
only kind of, yeah. But like with the rest of it, I when I hear this, I kind of think of like the introduction to like a ballroom.
Yeah.
And you have like the band over there playing and you have people in their fancy dresses like dancing. But it'd be like over in like England or something. Like, for the court and the Duchess and please shut up. America. America.
So I have to say about Dick Tracy. We'll see you next time.
Later.
But they also put out a tie-in board game
for
this. Which I have, and we've played it a few times, and it's a
board game.
It's a board game. It's not super great. It's about how you expect a tie-in. Like, we got to make up things so this kind of works, but do like movie elements. And so there's, you know, like cards, like how you would have the like chance cards in Monopoly that say like you get the bath, or, you know, like you get shook down for money, or your club gets busted for gambling or whatever.
It's a board game.
It's a board game
based off of a movie.
It is.
I'm good.
They
thanks, fam.